From the Sky News Centre at 6, British and US intelligence agencies are investigating a data breach affecting 500 million people. Passport and payment information of Marriott hotel customers was first accessed in 2014. It happened in America and affected the company's Starwood properties, which include luxury London sites like the Park Lane Sheraton Grand and Le Méridien Piccadilly. Our defence and security correspondent Alistair Bunkle is in Washington, D.C.
This is big. By my reckoning, the biggest ever hack was Yahoo back in 2016, 3 million pieces of data. This is half a billion, and I reckon it is in the top two or three hacks of all time.
It'll be no deal or no Brexit at all if MPs reject Theresa May's proposals in less than a fortnight. That warning's been issued by the head of the European Council, Donald Tusk, as the world's leading nations meet in Argentina. After months of rail strikes and disruption caused by new timetables, ticket prices are going up again in January. Passengers will pay 3.1% extra on average, which works out at around £100 more over the year.
It's been delays all the time.
Everything about the trains here is just ridiculous.
Oh, the service is appalling.
But the industry says the extra money will pay for improvements. The inquest into the death of a Welsh politician accused of inappropriate behaviour with three women has been adjourned indefinitely. Carl Sargent was found dead at his home after being sacked as Cabinet Secretary for Communities and Children. A Team GB rower is in a coma after a serious accident in Seattle. It's understood Anna Thornton, who's from Nottingham, fell down some stairs earlier this month. And Priyanka Chopra and Nick Jonas have arrived in Jodhpur in India for what's being called the Celebrity Wedding of the Year. The Bollywood star and singer's guests include Nick's brother Joe Jonas and his fiancée, Game of Thrones actress Sophie Turner. There'll be two ceremonies on Sunday, a traditional Hindu wedding and a Christian service, officiated by Jonas's father. That's the latest. I'm Daisy Gray.
Love Bristol. Love. BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday. It's 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Labour councillor for Brislington West, Harriet Bradley. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, a 9/11 breakthrough in the US court system this week. And also more evidence of Israel being behind the attack from US author Chris Bolin. And Ukraine and Russia clash off Crimea. What were those three Ukrainian naval ships up to? And does this have anything to do with the Ukrainian president elections and Petro Poroshenko being rated only 8% in the polls? Russian military say British special forces are in Ukraine right now preparing a chemical weapons attack. Is there any truth to that? Accusation? Why and where? And what happened to the people who scoured Iraq for weapons of mass destruction? What do they think of the state of the Middle East and what the illegal invasion of Iraq has done to the Middle East today? Religion of artificial intelligence, yes, created by a former Google executive earlier this year, with Facebook and Google also being hauled through the courts this week. And Martin Summers has a chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after seven. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs around 14. Crikey, that's a bit warm, isn't it? Light showers and fairly breezy. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius. Plenty of showers, though. Some sunny spells and fairly breezy. Next weekend, the 8th and 9th of December, highs around 10 Celsius. Sunshine and fleeting showers. So, yes, this weekend's warmish, but a bit breezy and showery. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Brislington West, Harriet Bradley. Hi, Harriet. Welcome to the Politics Show again.
Hi. Pleasure to be here, Tony.
We haven't spoken to you for a little while.
No, I have been here before, but only in the old place. This is very grand.
Must be over a year ago. Yep. Yes, the Grand Eastern Community Centre, we like to call it. So give us a sort of from the coal face what's been going on in Brislington West, because I know there are all sorts of problems people have been having, literally just staying in their homes and, well, paying the rent, but also keeping food on the table, that sort of thing.
Yes, well, I've just been reading Philip Alston's report to the United Nations, and it makes shocking reading, to be honest. The stats in it are horrendous. They're predicting that in about 5 years' time, it'll be one in two kids in Britain that live in poverty. And the food bank situation, there's now over 2,000, and 10 years ago there were 29. So we're really seeing an absolute crisis of poverty and particularly homelessness. And that's all bound up with the rolling out of universal credit, which not only reduces the payment for people who are living on benefits, or those who are living have to depend on benefits because of being in very poorly paid work, but it also has a very punitive sanctions regime, so it's pushing people to the edge. So I think the thing that's worrying us all really at the moment is homelessness, and of course in Bristol we do have a major homelessness problem. It's actually worse here than the national average. So they calculate, Shelter calculates that one in 170 people is homeless in Bristol. You know, that's a lot of people. Some of them are on the streets, and that worries people. Others are living with friends or relatives. And I had a case, for example, of a young woman whose husband was coercive, stole all her money. She had to come back and live with her parents because she couldn't get her onto a housing list. And there's such a queue for council housing in Bristol.
The trouble with this austerity, it seems to me, I mean, apart from all of the stuff you've talked about, is that one of the primary targets seems to be children.
Yes. This is so awful. You know, these are the young people that are growing up and they're not having a chance. Teachers tell me that they have to take food to school. There are holiday programs, which Anna Keane, who's the education person, has set up to feed the kids during the holiday periods because their parents can't afford food for them. And as I said, food bank use in Bristol has increased 25% since the summer. And as we get into the winter, all these problems get worse, don't they? Because people have to contend with the weather. So I'm thinking of all these poor guys sleeping in doorways and in tents. We've been told that people sleep out in Nightingale Valley in the woods in Brislington. You know, think of doing that in this kind of windy, wet weather. It's horrendous.
Well, also, the council don't take very kindly to people going into parks and sleeping
in tents. No, they don't. No, they have taken some quite brutal measures, which I really deplore. I think that's not the way to deal with it. Where do they think people will go if they're chased out of parks?
Well, hang on. You're a councillor. What can you do about this?
What
because
can I
surely do?
Surely,
you can at least,
yeah,
the very least, you can have a word in the all-powerful Lord Marvin Rees, the mayor's ear, and say, Marvin, we can't allow this.
I think one of the problems is that a lot of these policies actually don't come to us as councillors. They're driven by the officers. So we have protested about many of these things, and I'm hoping that those are being solved. But in Brislington, we have a special problem, which you may have heard about, Tony. We've got this place, Wick House, which has been in the news recently, which is a shelter which has got 80-plus residents living there. But it's not very well managed, and the residents that are in it there don't get any help. They don't get any rehabilitatory treatment. They're just sort of really farmed in there. And the money, of course, which they get from housing benefit, goes into the pockets of the people who own the house, which is a beautiful house, by the way, and into the charity, which purports to to be caring for these people, but they're not being cared for. And I really, it really worries me what we're going to do with the increasing numbers, because I think the only decent way to house people is for the council to actually provide adequate shelters. And to praise my colleague, Councillor Paul Smith, we also in Brislington have this new place at St Anne's House, which used to be a council office for housing, as you may recall. And we've got 30 people moving in there into proper, decent accommodation. It's 24-hour, it's supervised, and there's all sorts of facilities to help them learn to feed themselves. We're going to be going over there, we're taking books and food and stuff. So that's the way to do it, but we just don't have the resources in Bristol, or anywhere at the moment, because of the Tory cuts. I have to go back to that as the main cause.
Well, you mentioned Philip Alston. Do you want to say something about him? Because I've got a clip of Jeremy Corbyn talking about him in a minute.
Oh, have you? Oh, brilliant. Yes. Well, he went around and talked to people all over the country. He's been up and down. He's talked to people like Shelter. He's talked to food bank people. He's talked to lots of people all over the country in different bits of the country. And they're all telling him the same tales of struggle, of not being able to cope, of having to choose between paying the rent, feeding their children, paying the bills. What would you do? You know, they feed their children, of course, because, you know, we British people are very family-oriented people. But the main thing that he says is that the government is in denial. It won't accept there's a problem. All it keeps saying is that universal credit will help people to get back into work, and we just can't see how that is the case.
Seems like we're moving towards a sort of social Darwinist society where, yeah, survival of the fittest.
Absolutely. I mean, the figures for people who've died through austerity, I don't know how credible they are, but they come up from time to time, and it is very worrying. I know that there has been a massive increase in suicide and suicide attempts. There's all this mental distress among young people, among students. I mean, we're really, it's become a very ruthless and unpleasant society. And this is, as everyone keeps saying, the fifth richest society in the world. Why are we in this state? It's very hard to understand, I think, particularly for us old people who grew up in the prime period of the welfare state.
Well, what do you say to the Conservatives? You say actually there's more people in employment now than there's ever been.
What employment is what I say, because it's low paid, insecure employment. And that's one of the things that I think is problematic about universal credit. It's based on you giving them information about your pay, you have to give them bank statements or pay slips, and they all feed that into their computer, which then spits out what you are paid. And it doesn't take into account that so many people are in the gig economy, where they don't know what kind of work they're going to have next week. They're not on stable pay, they're not in stable jobs. They lose a job, they have to go for another. Even people, you know, even graduates are in this situation. We've done some research on graduates, and we find they, for example, young lawyers, taken on as paralegals on a project, 6 months, then they're all sacked. They have to go off and look for another one.
Well, you don't have to look too far. Look around the studio, you'll find two graduates who are in the gig economy.
Yes, exactly.
With no stable employment.
Yeah, there you are.
They just get bits of work from time to time.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. And that's the what faces so many young people in society. And, you know, as a professor, which I was before I became a councillor, these people are so young and full of passion and energy and creativity. What are we doing to them? It's shocking. It's shocking.
Professor of what?
Sociology.
Okay, great subject. Love it. C. Wright Mills. I don't know if you've ever read
him. Oh, absolutely. Yes, great man.
American.
Yeah.
Sociological
imagination.
And his leather jacket, used to ride around on his motorbike, I seem to remember. But he was a terrific author in the 1950s.
He was wonderful, yes.
Now, let's have a listen now to, I was going to play the Philip Alston, the UN clip. But I thought, since we're talking about types of employment, we'll have a listen to someone at Prime Minister's Questions who brought up the attempt to downgrade the pay and conditions of people working in shipbuilding.
Dan Carden!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister is currently travelling the country seeking public support for her Brexit deal that she says will secure industry and jobs. So will she visit Camel Laird shipyard in Birkenhead, where workers have been forced into industrial action fighting the threat of casualisation, to save hundreds of skilled, secure jobs in Merseyside at a company that has won £620 million of government RAF contracts? Because what faith can people have in the future she offers if she will not act to save skilled, secure jobs in our own defence industry?
Can I first of all say to the Honourable Gentleman, I realise what a worrying time this must be for the employees of Camel Laird. Obviously, the government doesn't have a role in the strategic direction or management of the company, but officials are in touch with the company, officials are in close contact with the company and are being kept informed. And I hope that there can be a dialogue between all sides to work together to come to a solution that is in the best interests of all involved. But as I say, I recognise what a worrying time this must be for the employees of that company.
Feigning concern there, the Prime Minister, about casualisation, Martin. But this is happening to all of our industries, really, isn't it?
Well, it is. And, of course, the global picture is very worrying. GM is just laying off 16,000 workers. And they, of course...
General Motors.
They were bailed out by Obama, if you remember. And the stock market is basically teetering as we speak, and that's not just the to do with British conditions. We're talking about global conditions, and of course the G20 is taking place in Argentina at the minute, and the trade wars that Trump is initiating are going to be the main topic of the discussion.
Teetering on the brink. Do you think Brexit is going to be that little nudge that sends it over?
Well,
the
I mean, we've got our own particular circle of hell here that we've got to navigate. But of course, the real problem in Europe, of course, is the Italian banking system. Monte dei Paschi in Siena is the oldest bank in the world, and it's basically been taken over by the Italian government.
Deutsche Bank was a little bit iffy.
Well, they're all linked together, but of course, if the Italian banking system collapses, which it may well do, that will pull down Deutsche Bank, it will pull down the British banking system. And, there's all sorts of potential things all over the world which could trigger a crash. And the conditions are absolutely ripe for a massive crash of a
Do you remember the days when everything was rosy and there was more people had jobs? That was in the noughties. This was the guy who was in charge of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, and we're hearing very little from him, I'm afraid. It'd be nice to see him on Question Time or something like that, giving his point of view. Because now he's not in the job, he's not got to say what he's supposed to say, and he can actually say what he thinks. And here he is, a month or so ago, just talking to a slightly irritating interviewer from Bloomberg about Brexit and the crash.
So I think one should be careful in using the phrase populism. It's like the word austerity. People devise these words to represent something they don't like without being clear about the meaning of it. So populism has many illustrations, if you like. In southern Europe, it's a perfectly rational rejection of excessive fiscal consolidation to cope with a badly designed monetary union. I understand why people think that. In the United States, populism is about the reaction by those people whose wages have been held down through a combination of technological developments and globalization. They feel left behind. They haven't benefited in the way that people in New York and other metropolitan centers have from the benefits of the globalization of the last 30 years. They feel ignored, and their real wages have been depressed. So that's a different motive for it. And I think in the case of Brexit, it was a very clear referendum on a very specific issue, which was should the UK remain a member of the European Union. It wasn't about wages or anything else. And I think people should respect that. The idea that the British population was hoodwinked in a referendum because they really were concerned about something else, as opposed to membership of the European Union, I think is a rather arrogant view. There are many lines that you could draw leading towards so-called populism. I think the financial crisis was certainly one of them, and I think the reason for that is that in the 30 years before that, a lot of ordinary people, a lot of small businesses, had accepted that the discipline of the market, even though it's unpleasant when you discover that your firm is not winning orders and so jobs go and the firm goes out of business, is nevertheless the right way forward to a thriving market economy which can generate productivity growth and higher real wages. So they bought into that. Come the financial crisis, well, having refused to bail out weak firms in the 30 years beforehand, the government was bailing out banks. Now, there was a very good reason for that, which is if the banks had failed, the whole economy would have ground to a halt. And we tried to explain that. It was very clear, I would say in Parliament, that we're not doing this to protect the banks. We're trying to do this to save the economy from the banks.
Is Brexit a good thing for Britain, do you think?
Well, people have different views on it. I myself don't think it's going to make a dramatic difference. I think you can argue that being a sovereign nation, having control over our own borders, is a big plus. You can also argue that if you want to genuinely be part of a European Union where we accept a high degree of political unity with other countries, it's a bad thing. People can take different views on it. It isn't an argument where it's obvious what is right or wrong. But I think what was so depressing, what is still depressing about the debate, is why both sides of this argument are absolutely convinced. They know the consequences very clearly. One side thinks they'll be disastrous. The other side thinks that we'll be a land of milk and honey. Neither side is right on that. And what we needed to do back in 2016 was to say, look, we had a referendum campaign. We got a result. Both sides in the campaign said very clearly, there's no doubt about this, that leaving means leaving the single market and leaving the customs union. Prime Minister Theresa May reiterated that on more than one occasion. Yet here we are, 2 years later, more than 2 years later now, and we still don't know what the arrangements are going to be for single market, customs union, etc., etc. None of this was necessary if proper planning had been put in place right back in 2016. So our political system has made a mess of it. It's not the decision to leave or stay in the EU that's made a big difference. It's the political consequences of that discussion and vote that have caused the problems, not the underlying economics of it.
There are some that say that Brexit is kind of comparable for the City of London to Lehman Brothers. Is that are they in any way comparable?
No, they're not comparable at all.
Will the effects be comparable?
No, Lehman Brothers was something that we knew the banking system was undercapitalized, but the final few days of Lehman Brothers were dramatic and could have led to a collapse of the entire US financial system. Brexit is not remotely comparable with that. The other side of the coin is that solving the problem of the banking failures in the US and the UK at that time was relatively straightforward. And by the time we got to spring of 2019, the banking crisis as such was over. Resolving the issues surrounding Brexit will take much, much longer. So it's a much more drawn-out process of solving a whole sequence of practical problems. But the long-run consequences, 30 or 40 years down the road, we don't know what they'll be, is the only honest answer. We just don't know. But, you know, I find it hard to see why they should be really significant in comparison with a collapse of the financial system and the economy grinding to a halt, a repeat of the 1930s Great Depression. Or indeed, the sort of changes we've seen in our own economy in the last 40 or 50 years. Just don't think it's going to be quite such a big event. What it is a very dramatic political event. It's our political system that's collapsed, not our economy.
Well, he's been quite damning of the politicians there, Mervyn King. I suppose he wasn't really allowed to do that while he was Governor of the Bank of England. But he's saying, really, it's you politicians that are messing things up, Harriet. Not necessarily you personally. But
God, no.
So what does the Labour Party stand on this?
Well,
it seems that the Labour Party is just trying to use this to get themselves a general election, if they possibly can. And they don't really care about the other consequences.
I'm not sure that's true. I mean, if I can try and summarise what I think is the Labour Party position on Brexit, which is very complicated, and I'm giving the view which I think is the one that I have held of what the leadership is up to. I mean, like the Lib Dems and the Greens, the Labour Party during the referendum was firmly Remain. There were a few Labour MPs who joined in the Leave campaign, but they were only a handful and not significant. And the main leaders of the party, all of them campaigned for Remain. But when the referendum was over, the position taken by Corbyn certainly was, this is a democracy, we've had a vote, this is the result, we can't overturn that. Now, that's different from the Lib Dems and the Greens, who both continued to say that leaving is disastrous, we've got to remain, and therefore we need a second referendum or a people's vote or whatever. Well, the Labour Party was placed in a very difficult position because its supporters were split down the middle. You know, the people in Bristol West, where I happen to live, are 100% for Remain. The middle classes in London want to remain. But up north, I mean, I think to some extent, for not very pleasant reasons, because there is a very strong anti-immigrant rhetoric that's in there, but they all voted leave. They've said they wanted to leave, and they're sticking with it. You know, I don't think we have real evidence that there's been a major shift of thinking. So the Labour Party has had to sit on the fence in a way, which is always not a very admirable position, but a position that I think I would probably, if I were in the leadership, I'd probably have done exactly what Jeremy Corbyn has done.
It sounds like what you're saying is the Labour Party actually wants to remain, but they won't admit it. And they're not allowed to say it. Martin, what do you think? And what do you think of what Mervyn King had to say there?
Well, I think, I can't remember everything that he said because it was quite a long clip there.
He was saying things like, actually, he doesn't think that is a big impact at all.
Well, I mean, what I've always felt, Tony, is that Brexit is essentially a diversion from a discussion of the things we were talking about earlier, the banking system. Yeah. Deutsche Bank, you mentioned it. And the real danger of a disorderly breakup of the EU, which is definitely on the cards, is that the banking system will collapse. And we won't be talking about Brexit, we'll be talking about what we're going to do about the collapsed banking system.
It's a little bit like 2008, where rather than having the City of London and Wall Street holding the gun to the heads of the politicians saying do what we want or else, it's now becoming the European Central Bank doing it.
Well, the ECB is not, the problem is that the European Union is not strong enough to do what it needs to do to resolve the crisis, and that includes the crisis in Italy, because Italy is a much bigger economy than Greece, and they're basically playing chicken with the Germans.
And what about Spain?
Well, Spain, they will befall into the contagion.
Yeah.
The big danger at the minute is Italy, and of course the Spanish banks are very well, very exposed to the Turkish lira's collapse.
This is the sort of thing
that we should have been talking about. Brexit is navel gazing, frankly.
Sounds to me like, you know, a bit of a Brexit.
Mervyn King pointed out, even if Brexit goes ahead, it'll take years to resolve it, and it's not really, because something much more fundamental is going to come up and bash us over the head long before we get there.
Well, we'll see. It's only 3 months to go for that thing to bash us on the head.
Well, I mean,
if we have a Brexit, and before I get your final views on Brexit, which way do you think it's all going to go, let's have a listen to the former Brexit Secretary David Davis on what he thought last week of Theresa May's so-called deal with the EU.
I'm afraid, as I said, we must be ready for Project Fear 2.0. The task facing the Conservative Party, the governing party, is to deliver the will of the people as set out in June 2016. That means Brexit, and it means a clean Brexit that ensures a decisive break from the influence of a foreign power. The withdrawal agreement and the political declaration are a bogus prospectus. They'll keep Britain in orbit around the European Union, and we will be nothing more than a satellite state ruled from
Brussels. That's what he's saying. Anyway, we've had David Davis giving his two apence as well. So both of you, you first, Harriet, and then you, Martin, what do you think it's going to be? Is it going to be no deal? Is it going to be no Brexit? Or is it going to be Theresa May's deal?
In some ways, I think Theresa May's deal isn't as awful as people have been saying. It is a kind of soft Brexit, which is why the right wing of the Tories don't like it and are agitating to try and get rid of her. I'm a Remainer myself, I'll be honest, and what I will regret if we do go out of Europe is the freedom to the freedom of mobility, to be able to go there without having to pay visas and all the rest of it. But what will happen...
I think they're talking about visa-free travel to, certainly to France and Holland and places like this. You won't need a visa. You may need, to some countries, but there'll be passport checks and all this sort of thing.
I mean, young people that I was talking about before, a lot of them want to work in Europe and they won't have that. But anyway, just going back to what will happen, I mean, I'm pretty well sure that the vote will be lost because of the DUP, essentially. I would find it very difficult to know what will happen then. Obviously, the Labour Party would absolutely love to have a general election, and we believe very sincerely that we could win it because we think the Tory Party is in disarray and that people are beginning to realise how bloody awful this phase of capitalism is. And we got good policies, and we'll have even better policies. So that would be great, but I'm afraid it won't happen because I think the Tories are too scared of a socialist government, and they'll hatch up some plot to keep May in or else find a successor, though God knows who.
Martin, it'd probably be Boris, won't it? Martin, don't Labour generally seem to want a soft Brexit? And surely that's pretty much what Theresa May's offering, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in other circumstances, if we had a PR system like in Denmark or Greece,
and what you're saying
Germany,
is you're going to vote against it because it's a Tory plan.
Yeah, because
it's good.
Everybody's playing chicken here. The right wing of the Tory party ought to support this deal, because if they don't, they may end up with no Brexit at all, because no deal Brexit, there simply isn't a parliamentary majority for that, or a majority in the country. In actual fact, when people voted to leave the European Union, it was held up to them that we could have a Norway option, and the Norway option is that you're basically in the single market but you're not in the European Union. And if we did that, we wouldn't have to waste money sending Nigel Farage and people like Ian Paisley to the European Parliament. We'd save a lot of money by not going to the meetings. And we just have to. I mean, inevitably,
would you save $39 billion?
Well, we could save quite a lot. But I mean, the point I'm making is this: in any case, whatever you do, you're going to be trading. Most of our trade is carried out with our immediate neighbours because that's just the way it works. And you're going to have some kind of relationship with them, one way or another.
There is one.
And the
point,
EU are basically going to dictate to you because they're bigger than you are.
Let me explain why I think no.
Why do you think no?
It's because actually the trade is far more coming in from the EU to Britain than going the opposite direction.
No, that's not true.
What about all the fish and
that's not true. We've got a massive trade deficit
that goes to France.
Yeah,
we sell more to EU than they sell to us. That's just not true.
That's true. The EU sells more to us. So in other words, a Brexit which makes us poorer will make them poorer, which is why they don't really
they
want
don't
it
like
to happen.
It.
They have more of an incentive to get
this deal is the best that there's going to... I mean, the problem for the Labour Party is that if we won the general election, one of the interesting things I've been reading is that Theresa May, if she doesn't get this vote through, she may call a general election to scupper her own right wing and say, right, back me. Yeah. And that's what she may decide to go down that road in order to get them in line, which of course would be exactly what we want.
So Theresa May would give the Labour Party their chance, their big chance.
Yes, and of course I think the likely outcome of an election would be a Labour-led coalition with
that
other forces.
That is probably right.
And then of course you could then start talking about how we would finesse our relationship with the EU.
You mean how you would reverse the decision?
No, we're not reversing the decision. We will leave the EU, but we will stay in the single market, which is not... Nigel Farage and the DUP both said, if you vote for leave the EU, it doesn't mean you'll have to leave the single market. They said we can stop freedom of movement and the Germans will still carry on allowing access to the single market.
Martin,
that
you've
was
got
wrong.
This thing about everybody apparently before the election, the referendum, saying, we can leave the single market.
What the ballot paper said is, do you want to leave the EU? It didn't mention the single market.
Well, that is the EU.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, Norway's had two referendums both times.
They're not in the EU.
No, they're not. They're in the single market, though, Tony.
They can be in the EU. Yes, they can be.
Yeah, they're in the single market, but they're not in the EU. And in actual fact, from their point of view, that's actually quite a sensible policy.
Norway,
they're a small country, and by joining the EU, they wouldn't get much influence anymore than they've got now.
Then what happens is you get no influence at all, but you pay all the money.
Well, we'll just have to accept that, won't we? If we're going to accept the referendum result.
Martin, you keep shouting. Can you stop it, please? What I'm saying here is that people decided they wanted to leave the EU. That is there's potential that they might stay in the single market, but that discussion was all had, and we decided to leave.
No,
Liam Fox admits, Martin, Liam Fox admits that Brexit might not happen. Do you think, why is he saying that?
That's an interesting
possibility.
Can we just let Harriet say
that? Yeah. No, I think that is a possibility. And I've always sort of wondered whether perhaps all this havering and making it go on and all the negotiation was a way of actually sort of making it so impossible that the only thing to do was to say, oh God, let's forget it and let's stay in. And if I were Theresa May, to be honest, I'd probably be saying that's other people's vote. And then it's a way out for her. And she could say, oh, I've listened to the people again. We don't have to have an election. I stay in power, but we don't have to leave. And you all be a bit pissed off with me, but there we go. That's what I would do if I were her, actually.
Okay. Well, let's go back to Philip Alston and his little tour around the country from the United
Nations.
Are we
leaving Brexit then?
Yes. yes. And let's have a listen to what... Well, we don't know, and I think that's one of the things Mervyn King said, isn't it? You know, we don't know, but anyone that pretends they do is wrong. Simple as that. Good old Mervyn, I love him. So let's have a listen now to the damning UN report on Tory austerity as discussed at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday.
Mr Speaker, after 8 years of making our economy weaker through austerity... Brexit threatens more of the same. Professor Alston said in his damning UN report into UK poverty, and I quote, in my meetings with the government, it was clear to me that the impact of Brexit on people in poverty is an afterthought. In her Chequers plan, the Prime Minister promised frictionless trade with Europe after Brexit. Her future partnership guarantees no such thing. Does the Prime Minister understand why MPs are queuing up not to back her plan?
I can tell the Right Honourable Gentleman who is backing my plan. Farmers in Wales, fishermen in Scotland, employers in Northern Ireland. And when MPs come to look at this vote, they will need to look at the importance of us delivering on Brexit and ensuring that we deliver Brexit and doing it in a way that protects jobs. And on that subject, he referenced what had happened to the economy over the last 8 years. We've seen the number of young people not in education, employment or training at record lows. We see borrowing this year at its lowest level for 13 years. We see more people in work than ever before. The fastest regular wage growth for nearly a decade. And today, we've seen the number of children living in workless households at a record low and the proportion of workless households at a record low. That's good balanced management of the economy by the Conservatives.
Well, Martin Summers, the economy doesn't really seem to be doing as well as Theresa May is painting it. What would you do if you were John McDonnell and you were given an opportunity, a general election, to change things?
Well, I think what people have got to recognise is that underlying this false prosperity has been zero interest rates and quantitative easing. That was supposedly going to be a short-term measure for a few months. That was 10 years ago. And what's actually happened in Britain and elsewhere is a massive bubble has been created, financial bubble, which then feeds through into the economy as people having low-wage, low-productivity jobs. But, of course, we're going to hit a brick wall. Either Brexit or something else is going to bring us down. And at that point, there's going to be if there's going to be a no-deal Brexit, which is quite possible given the circumstances, because, you know, unless something is done, that's where you end up. There'll be a run on the pound. The speculators will be lining up to make money for old rope by selling the pound, shorting the pound.
So it doesn't matter what British people or voters want. We have to do whatever the markets dictate.
Well, indeed. And in actual fact, it might be a good thing for that to happen while the Tories are still in power, because you might get a run on the pound with the Labour government anyway. So we might as well get that out of the way. And everybody, you know, would crash the housing market because of Brexit, and then we sweep to power and then sort it all out by nationalising everything, including the banks.
So finally, then, what's your guess? Will it be no Brexit, no deal? Just let me finish my sentence. Will it be no deal, no Brexit, or will it be Theresa May's deal?
I think Theresa May's deal is obviously dead on arrival. That's not going to happen because the numbers just aren't there in Parliament. I think
is she going around the country appealing to ordinary people who aren't actually going to be taking part in this vote in Parliament?
Well, she's hoping to put pressure on her own MPs.
She's trying to guilt trip the MPs, is she?
Yeah, that's the idea. And I think the one interesting thing I read this week, and I can't remember who said it, was that if she fails, she might go back for a second vote, but if she loses by a big margin, there's no point. And she may then decide, I'm going to go to the country. And because in many ways, what she's offering is actually the sort of thing that business could live with. The problem is, politically, there's nobody going to buy it. And as long as the right wing of the Tory party are determined on Harry Kirry, then I can't see that the Labour party are going to prevent
them. Let's get back down to earth, because rail fares are to rise by 3.1% in January. The rise announced by industry body, the Rail Delivery Group, although quite what they're delivering other than profits for shareholders is beyond me, follows a year of disruption on some lines. There have been calls for a price freeze following the chaos caused by the introduction of new timetables in May. Now, the word fake news comes to mind, because this is the news story today, this 3.1 increase in fares, and yet only last night this is on the news.
The rail regulator has ordered Network Rail to urgently address shortcomings in its handling of Britain's rail infrastructure or face a fine. It said punctuality and reliability on the system were at their lowest point in 5 years. Network Rail said it was committed to working closely with train operators to improve its performance.
Well, they can say that, and then they can do absolutely nothing about it, which they normally do. Quite why the BBC can't remember what last night's news was and compare today's biggest ever increase with yesterday's biggest ever disaster and the actual service. What's going on, Harriet?
Oh, well, I can tell you that I've had some disastrous journeys. Coming back Christmas from holiday abroad, we got stuck Redhill station, with no trains coming in and out for about 2 hours, freezing to death, and we're all herded into a tiny little room about as big as this, the waiting room. I haven't had a journey this year on a train, a long distance journey, that hasn't been full of disasters, cancelled trains going to the wrong place. I mean, it's just been chaos.
So it's okay to put the fares up by...
No, it isn't. It's appalling. And we the Labour Party here has been demonstrating every year against these fare rises. I can't understand why it's happening, because GWR trains, when I get on them, are always absolutely stuffed to the gills. So they must be raking the money in. I was on a very, very busy train going to the Welsh rugby match last Saturday, which Wales won, which was great. But again, the train from London was so full that even in the first class, everybody was standing. And they had to lay on a special train, which was also full to the gills. So, you know, lots of people are travelling by train. It's this is why, as Martin just said, we really need to renationalise our transport systems. And that goes for the buses as well, because a private bus system like the one by First in Bristol simply cannot cater for the services that the city needs. And that means a car takes over. And we all know the things that come from that, the pollution, the traffic jams, people getting stuck and can't come into work, etc.
Whereabouts was John McDonnell going to find the money to nationalise the railways?
Well,
then?
It's quite straightforward to rationalise the railways, because they're all franchised, so when the franchises come due, you just don't renew them. And that's what happened with the East Coast Main Line. But of course, the Tories have privatised it again, and they let Virgin, they let off money that they, because they bid the wrong price, and that's basically handing Virgin millions of taxpayers' money, because they should have had to operate it at a loss, because they put in a bid that was too low. But instead, they were allowed to opt out of the bid, and the government then picked up the tab. That's the sort of thing that goes
driven
on all
by
the time.
Ideology, aren't they?
Well, it is, and of course,
in actual fact,
the nationalisation of the railways is fairly straightforward. It's the nationalisation of the banking system that's going to be the killer. But of course, if they are bankrupt, then you don't have to pay any money for them. Yeah, you just take them over. That's it. And they will be bankrupt.
Okay, well, I mean, let's hope that something happens, because it just seems that there's less and less trains, less and less buses, even though more and more people need to use them all the time. And the actual service that
the bus use in Bristol apparently has increased 46%.
but it's from a low base.
It was from a low base.
We've had 3 months of not enough drivers.
Absolutely. We still have
They're not paying enough wages. That's an obvious market thing, isn't it? You're just not paying them enough, are you?
But actually, what if you're a shareholder?
That's what it depends. Who's running it for what purpose, isn't it?
Well, there are more buses than ever. There's a metro bus. There's all these students who've arrived in Bristol travelling on the buses, and they've put the fares up. I mean, they're going to have a bumper year for the shareholders, as far as I can see. And why I don't understand why they're not prepared to put more money back into the workforce.
Well, that's not what they're there for, is it?
Well, we had an announcement. We had an announcement this week.
This is the problem about privatised industry.
There's 7 new routes planned for Bristol's metro bus. It seems like these little metro buses with the funny little wheels, sideways wheels that stick out. Goodness knows what they're... I mean, it just seems to me some sort of silly gimmick. I don't know. They help them along the guided rails, apparently, but why not just forget them? Because it doesn't really seem to make much difference.
Unicorn horns on.
these are pretty much as good as unicorn horns, aren't they? Anyway, it's part of an 18-year transport strategy, apparently, run by councils across the Greater Bristol area. Council report says the routes have been chosen to enable sustainable economic growth, accessibility, and accommodate new housing and employment growth. If all schemes are approved, the total bill could top £700 million. The routes considered are Bristol City Centre to Avonmouth and Severnside, Bromley Heath to Yate, Baron Ashton to Nailsea and Clevedon, Bristol to Bath along the A4, Bristol Parkway to the Mall at Cribbs Causeway via Patchway, an orbital route connecting South Bristol to Emerson's Green and Western Supermare Town Centre to the M5 Junction 21 developments. I guess that bus is going to go fairly slowly past Brislington, isn't it, Harry?
Well,
unless they do my dreamed of underpass. I mean, I'd like to see the tunnel going underneath Brislington people can get through Brislington, because it's one of the slowest places in the city, isn't it?
It is terrible, and my constituents complain all the time about it. There is a solution proposed, which is the Callington Road bypass, to take traffic off the Bath Road. Were you aware of that? That's part of the joint spatial plan. It will go round from the Tesco in Callington Road round to the Sainsbury in St Philip's Marsh, and thus channel traffic through to the M32, so they don't have to go into the centre and then out again. Well, that's the idea. I'm not convinced by
all the cars into Brislington. Every single car or bus will all be channeled into Brislington, and everything will grind to a halt.
Well, I think that's my idea, that it's a very stupid idea. But what the compensation for that is this idea of this rapid transit, which is what you're talking about in the Wecker plan, I believe. And that the idea that would go to Bath is certainly a good one, because there's far too much road traffic along there. But the main problem isn't really cars, actually. It's the big heavy vehicles that come in down
the
Bath Road.
Get them on
the
railways. Martin, you were at the bus protest, weren't you, last weekend?
Yeah, there was quite a good turnout. Most political activists, no Tories, but all the other political parties were represented there. And, we've been saying this for years. I mean, the fundamental problem, I mean, Steve Williams pointed out that the Metro Mayor, Tim
Bowles...
He's
the former Lib Dem MP.
Yeah, he's actually got the power to enforce a franchising regime similar to the one in London.
Absolutely.
But he doesn't want to, because he's a Tory.
He's a Tory.
Has he got shares in First Bus, Tim Bowles?
Well, no, it's as crude as that, but his business mates will be saying, oh, we don't want to do that, and so we're not going to do it.
It's the only solution to Bristol's problem, I believe.
Okay, here's my little pledge to you. We will drag Tim Bowles, kicking and screaming, onto a microphone here. And get him to explain.
Well, he has been here, hasn't he?
Well, I know, but last time he was saying, oh, yes, we're working on these wonderful transport schemes. He wasn't being very specific, but I think if we try and pin him down, maybe get that young activist from the university as well to discuss with him, that would be useful. Because, I mean, who is this guy? What does he do? You look at Bristol and its transport and you think, how on earth could you manage to elect a Conservative to be running transport
it's
in the
ridiculous,
city?
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
Well, what you do is you just send draw a big ring around the city, which is about 10, 20 miles out of the city. So you've got lots and lots of Tories who are involved in the decision. and then you elect a Metro Mayor to bodge it. Basically.
To do nothing.
Anyway, so
to do nothing, because we haven't even seen
him. We're all chanting, where is Tim? Where is Tim? Where is Tim?
Okay, so let's. Well, I did mention fake news a little there, but I want you to see if you can spot the fake news on this clip from last night's BBC News.
Some more of the day's news. The World Health Organization has warned that there's been a global resurgence in measles. An estimated 110,000 deaths last year were linked to the highly contagious disease. Experts say that complacency, collapsing health systems in some countries, and a rise in fake news about the measles vaccine are behind this rise.
Can you spot the fake news in there?
Well, that's, you know, the fake news. He said it was fake news.
What he said was the measles vaccine. Mm. It's not a measles vaccine.
It's a measles,
it's an MMR vaccine.
MMR, yeah.
And the thing is that when the drug companies introduced this MMR vaccine, they stopped producing the individual vaccines. So you can't choose to have your kids vaccinated for measles. So there's fake news of the day from Hugh Pym on BBC One last night.
Oh, well
there's
spotted.
Fake news all about the measles vaccine. No, 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 Hugh. MMR, it's called. And you can't get a measles vaccine in this country. Maybe you can privately, or on the black market, goodness knows. But anyway, what are your thoughts, Harriet, on this whole the MMR? What they call, some people call the MMR scare, don't they? But there is some evidence that we played an interview a few weeks ago with Andrew Wakefield. What he was saying was that the individual vaccines, measles, mumps and rubella, had all got approved. But actually the World Health Organization stepped in and stopped all the trials and research into the combined vaccine. So what happened is that the Department of Health, through probably the Care Quality Commission or somebody like that, or is it NICE? I think it's probably NICE.
NICE.
Said, oh, okay, nice. Well, what you've done is you've got all those three vaccines approved, and we will say it's okay to just put them all into one pot and inject them into kids without having to do trials, because you've already managed to get all these three approved. Any idea how safe this is? I mean, none of us are experts, but it's
Well, I'm certainly not an expert, no, but I know it. All I do know is that parents are very worried about it, because obviously nobody wants to undergo some kind of treatment that's going to harm their kid, and so of course people do reject it, and then the kids will get measles. But having said that, when I was a kid, I had measles, mumps and rubella, and I'm alive today.
we used to go around to people's houses to make sure you got it, didn't you?
You had to get it young, because it's much better to get these things young than old. So,
but you had separate injections, I imagine, rather than this combined one, which they are saying is potentially causing autism. One of the things is that there's a massive increase in autism. And it's not just since...
That is a good point.
It's not just since this has been brought in. Anyway, Martin, the drug companies do have a lot of sway now, don't they, over these groups like NICE. And I think, you know, this is one of the worries I have, is that a lot of the regulators, since so much was privatised, are actually rather weak. They're not as strong as they should be.
Well, it's what economists call regulatory capture. In other words, the drug companies are supposedly regulated, but in actual fact, they control the regulators. And in the US, you've got even further down the drain there. They've just agreed to produce and market a painkiller which is 100 times stronger than heroin. They've got a massive opioid death epidemic. 300,000 people have died in the US in last year, I think it is, and this massive increase in deaths from heroin and opioid abuse because of fentanyl. Fentanyl is 10 times stronger than normal heroin. This stuff is 100 times stronger. It'll be cut into street heroin. The drug companies basically got the regulators over a barrel. There's actually no case really for producing this stuff, but they think that they can make money from it, so that's what they're going to do. And the pharmaceutical companies, classic, that if we get the basic costs for the NHS, one of the biggest costs is paying pharmaceutical companies and their patents and so on. You nationalise it. This is a health issue. Drug production should be a nationalised industry. And the things you should do should be, you know, health-oriented rather than profit-oriented.
NICE has been quite cautious about drugs from the US in the past, though, hasn't it?
Because they're not to be trusted. Do you remember all the blood products came over in the 80s?
Yeah, exactly.
Contaminated blood products, which people selling their blood to...
Surely this is just about the Americanisation of the NHS, isn't it? The privatisation privatisation of the British health system. Actually, the British health system is the most efficient in the world, and the Americans is one of the least efficient. So what we're doing is we're just basically committing Harry Kiri for millions of people by destroying our own brilliant health system. God knows why. I think someone needs to stop that right now. But anyway, we'll finish this hour by having a look, I think, at something a little bit lighter, which is, either of you ever bought and sent a postcard of Bristol anywhere in the world?
Yes.
because there are lots of sort of traditional pictures of the Wills Building, the centre, I suppose, the floating harbour, these
Bridge.
Sorts of things. Well, the People's Republic of Stokescroft have done a competition this autumn, and they've had hundreds of entries for
Ooh.
Alternative postcards for the city.
Ooh, how
That's
nice.
How I listened
that
to
sounds lovely.
Lisa Furness, who's one of the curators up there, about this competition, which is just about, I think, tomorrow, is going on the website for people to make their own decision and have a people's vote on it. You said you wanted a people's vote.
Yeah.
This is the postcard people's vote.
We've just had the judges' selections in now. We have the 15 finalists for the over-18s competition in today, and we'll be announcing them publicly tomorrow. You will be able to go to the PRSC website, and you'll see a big button saying, "See finalists here." You can then look through the 15 finalists, and we're actually running a public vote to choose the final winner. So you can vote for your favourite on our website, or if you don't have that much access to the internet, we'll also be putting 15 to 20 ballot boxes around big public arts venues around the city with all 15 finalists displayed on them, so where you can physically vote, because we don't want people to be excluded through lack of access to the internet.
You're also putting up an exhibition at the Arts Centre itself, aren't you?
We are indeed. So if people are available to come down to the PRSC space in Stokescroft, we will be running an exhibition from Friday the 7th up to the 16th of December. It'll be open every single day from 1 till 5 p.m, and we'll also be doing a late opening on the Thursday until 8 p.m. Free entry, and in that exhibition we are going to be showing all 370 pictures which came in. This will be the only opportunity to see the pictures that weren't in the final.
You've got a lot of printing to do.
Yeah, we really do, and I'm actually really looking forward to seeing them on the wall. Between them, the collection paints such a striking, vivid, witty, personal vision of the city. It's a self-portrait of the city by the city, and I really think anyone who lives here or works here or has any opinion on what it's like to be in Bristol should come down and have a look.
Just to remind us again, when is it going to be open?
From Friday the 7th until the 16th of December, 1 till 5 every day, and then with a late opening until 8 o'clock on the Thursday.
Now, that Friday the 7th is also People's Comedy Day. What is People's Comedy?
PRSC teamed up with a couple of local comedians who are interested in political and social issues. We're doing our first big event this on Friday the 7th. We've applied for a late licence, so we'll be staying up late and celebrating political comedy and satire in all its forms. So that's also in our space. And obviously, if you come to that, the exhibition will be hanging on the wall around you, so you can see the postcards while enjoying the comedy. The People's Comedy is Bristol's first ever socio-political regular comedy night. It's been set up in partnership between PRSC and two comedians called Henry Palmer and John Matthews. And the first one, at the beginning of October, one of the most striking moments was when John Matthews ran a game called Hopkins or Hitler, where he read out quotes from Katie Hopkins and from Hitler, and the audience had to guess which was which.
So that's Friday. Oh, it's next Friday evening whilst we're live. So you could maybe listen to us on your headphones or something while you're in enjoying that. Well, time for Bristol, the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guest, Labour Councillor for Brislington West, Harriet Bradley. Join us after the news as Martin keeps us ahead of the curve.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.